Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Drew, for the introduction. And I can assure you I'm always busy, regardless of whether we're changing interest rates or not. I'd like to thank everybody here for attending. The Anika Foundation's doing fantastic work, and you heard Kate talk about some of that. So we can only do that work through your support. So thank you very much for coming to this lunch and supporting the Foundation. This is the third time that I've had the privilege of addressing this lunch. And I'd like to start my remarks today by winding the clock back, not by 3 years, but by 40 years. It was 40 years ago that I first started studying economics in high school in Wagga Wagga in country New South Wales. Fortunately, back in 1979, when I did the HSC, you could do three-unit economics. You can't do it today, I don't think. At the time, in the late 1970s, the standard HSC exam question was in two parts. The first part was, why did Australia have such high inflation and such high unemployment? And the second part of the exam question is, what should we do about it? What should public policy do about it? And I recall writing numerous essays on that topic. I also recall learning about the misery index. We don't really talk about that this index these days, which is good. But for those of you whose memories don't go back that far, that index is the sum of the unemployment rate and the inflation rate. And I thought it would be useful to show it you as background. As you can see, things were pretty miserable in the 1970s and the 1980s. Today, at least according to this metric, they're not too bad. The misery index is now the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. As we grapple with today's problems, I think it's important that we remind ourselves of this sometimes. So this means that today's HSC students, and I'm very pleased to see so many here, aren't going to be writing about high inflation and high unemployment. Rather, they're going to be writing about why is inflation so low, particularly when unemployment in many countries is so low. And I hope you're also being asked to write about what public policy should do about this, and also what it should be doing about its close cousins of low wage growth and low income growth in the household sector. These are really important issues to be thinking about. Given this, I'd like to use this opportunity to address two related questions that I'm asked frequently, and hopefully this will be of some help to the HSC students of today. The first one of these is, why is inflation so low globally and in Australia? And the second question is inflation targeting still appropriate in this low inflation world? I'll then draw on my answers to these two questions to provide some reflections about monetary policy in Australia. So to start off, why is inflation so low? It's useful to start off with a couple of graphs. The first is the average rate of inflation globally since the 1960s. I think the picture here is pretty clear. As you can see, global inflation declined over the past three decades, and since the early 2000s, it's been low and stable, and it's been that way for some time now. Over this period, low inflation has become the norm in almost every economy. This is evident in this next graph, which shows the share of advanced economies with a core inflation rate below 2% and the share below 1%. Currently, three quarters of advanced economies have an inflation rate below 2%, and one third have an inflation rate below 1%. The obvious question is, why has this happened? There's no single answer, but there are three factors that together help explain what's happened. These are the credibility of the monetary policy frameworks, the continuing existence of spare capacity in parts of the global economy, and the third is structural factors related to technology and to globalisation, and I'd like to say a few words about each of these. First, the credibility of the monetary policy frameworks. One of the responses to the high inflation rates of the 1970s and 1980s was to put in place monetary frameworks with a strong focus on inflation control. In some countries, this took the form of rewriting the central bank law to require the central bank to focus on just one thing, and that one thing was inflation. Many other countries adopt an inflation target, with the central bank's decisions routinely explained primarily in terms of inflation. This increased focus on inflation has helped cement low inflation norms in our economies. Many people understand that if inflation were to pick up too much, the central bank would respond to make sure that the pickup in inflation was only temporary. This means that workers and firms can make their decisions on the basis the inflation rate will be close to the central bank's target. And in my view, this has made the system considerably less inflation prone than it once was. The second explanation for low inflation is the continuing existence of spare capacity in parts of the global economy. The existence of spare capacity was an important factor explaining low inflation straight after the global financial crisis. And today it remains an important factor in some countries, including here in Australia. But at least on the surface, it's a less convincing explanation for low inflation in countries where unemployment rates are at multi-decade lows. These economies appear to be operating close to the limits of their full capacity. One explanation for continuing low inflation in this environment is that the current rate of aggregate demand growth is simply not fast enough to put meaningful pressure on supply capacity. And if that's the case, then stronger demand growth would be expected to see, we would expect to see inflation pick up. Another possibility is that the unemployment rate by itself no longer provides a good guide to spare capacity, particularly given the flexibility of labour supply, and I'll come back to this issue in the discussion of the Australian outcomes. The third explanation is that globalisation and advances in technology have changed pricing dynamics in our economies. And there are two main channels through which this happens. The first is by lowering the cost of production of many goods, and the second is by making more markets contestable and more competitive. The main effect of these changes should be on the level of prices rather than the ongoing rate of inflation. But the level effect is playing out over a long period of time, so it appears as persistently low inflation. I think this is likely to continue for a while yet. It's widely accepted that the entry into the global trading system of hundreds of millions of people with access to modern technology put downward pressure on the prices of manufactured goods. Reflecting this, the goods prices in the advanced economies have barely increased over the past couple of decades, as you can see in the bottom line in this graph. But the effects of globalisation and technology extend beyond the manufacturing sector into almost every corner of our economies, including the services sector. In today's globalised world, there are fewer and fewer services that can be thought of as truly non-traded. Many services can now be delivered by someone in another country. Examples include the preparation of architectural drawings, document design and publishing, customer service roles, and these days many people in professional services work with team members located in other economies. In addition, many tasks such as accounting and payroll can now be automated and performed somewhere else in the world. All this has been made possible by technology and by globalisation. These changes are having a material effect on pricing, with services price inflation lower than it once was, as you can see in this chart. Many firms know that if they don't keep their prices down, another firm somewhere in the world might undercut them. And many workers are concerned that if the cost of employing them is too high relative to their productivity, their employer might look overseas or consider automation. And more broadly, better price discovery through technology keeps competitive pressure on firms. The end result of these forces is a pervasive feeling of more competition. And more competition means lower prices. So these, at least in my view, are the three factors that are contributing to low inflation. None by themselves is sufficient to explain what's happening, but together they're having a powerful effect. The current high rates of inflation in Argentina and Turkey do remind us that globalisation and technology by themselves don't drive low inflation. The monetary framework clearly matters too, and weaknesses in that framework can still deliver and result in high inflation. So this brings me to the second question. Is inflation targeting still the appropriate monetary framework in most economies? It's understandable that people are asking this question. given the factors that I've just discussed. Some commentators have argued that central banks will find it increasingly difficult to achieve their inflation targets. Some then go on to argue that the central bank should just accept this, that they shouldn't fight it. Perhaps they should shift the goalposts or even adopt another monetary policy framework. A related argument is that very low interest rates that have accompanied inflation targeting are pushing up asset prices in an unsustainable way and sowing the seeds for future problems. You might or might not, hopefully, agree with these perspectives. Either way, it is reasonable to ask if we're on the right track. Is inflation targeting still appropriate? Before I address this question, I'd like to push back against the idea that central banks simply can't achieve their inflation targets. As we all know, some central banks have struggled to achieve their targets over a long period of time. You can see that on the left-hand side here. Japan and the euro area are kind of the most obvious examples. But their experience is not universal. Over recent times, inflation has been around target in Canada, and it's been around target in the United Kingdom, as you can see. It's also been around target in Norway and in Sweden. So the experience is mixed. There's no single factor that explains this mixed experience. But countries that are operating close to full capacity do seem more likely to have inflation close to target. It also appears that if you have an extended period of very low inflation, as did Japan and the euro area, it's harder to get inflation back to target as a deflationary mindset takes hold in parts of the community. It's also possible that demographics might be playing a role in Japan and the euro area, although the evidence is mixed here. Overall, these varying experiences do not support the idea that it's become impossible for central banks to achieve their targets. Here in Australia, some have argued that a lower inflation target would be a good idea, given the ongoing low rates of inflation, that we should adjust the current formulation of 2 to 3% on average over time. Now, lowering the target might have the superficial and short-run advantage of allowing the Reserve Bank to say that we've achieved our goal, that we've met the target. But shifting the goalposts hardly seems a good way of building long-term credibility. And shifting the goalposts could also entrench a low inflation mindset in the country. More broadly, over recent years, the international debate has gone the other way, that is to argue for a higher, not lower, inflation target. And the argument is that a higher rate of inflation, and thus a higher average level of interest rates, would promote economic welfare by providing more room to lower interest rates when it was needed without running up against the lower bound. And the argument here is the greater flexibility of monetary policy would allow for greater economic stabilisation when the economy was hit by an adverse shock. Now, to be clear, I'm not arguing for a higher inflation target, but rather acknowledging that there are arguments in both directions. So this brings me back to the core question. Is inflation targeting still appropriate? My short answer here is yes, but it's important to be clear what this means in practice. Inflation targeting can mean different things to different people. It comes in different shapes and sizes. Some versions require the central bank to focus on just inflation and set monetary policy so the forecast rate of inflation is equal to the target. But inflation targeting does not need to be rigid like this. In my view, an effective inflation targeting regime should consist of the following four elements. The first is that the inflation target should establish a clear and credible medium-term anchor, a nominal anchor for the economy. A high degree of uncertainty about future inflation hurts both investment and jobs. The economy works better if there's a degree of predictability. Most people, I think, can cope with some degree of variation in the inflation rate from year to year, but dealing with uncertainty about what the inflation rate's going to be over the medium term is more difficult for everybody. So inflation targeting plays an important role in reducing that uncertainty by providing a strong nominal anchor for the economy. The second feature of inflation targeting that I'd highlight is that the inflation target should be nested within the broader objective of welfare maximisation. It's worth remembering that inflation control is not the ultimate objective. Rather, it's a means to an end. And that end is the welfare of the society that we serve. I sometimes feel that as central banks sought to establish their anti-inflation credibility, they overemphasised the importance of short-run inflation outcomes, and this has been very difficult for them to walk back from. Some central banks have been concerned that if they gave weight to other considerations, the community might doubt their commitment to inflation control. So it became all about inflation. But central banks have a broader task than just controlling inflation in a narrow range. We play an important role in preserving macroeconomic stability and thus the steady creation of jobs in our economies. Also, our decisions affect borrowing and asset prices and thus financial stability too. Central banks have to determine how to balance these various considerations when making their decisions. This means it makes sense, at least from my perspective, for the inflation target to be embedded within the broader objective of maximising the welfare of our society. The third feature of inflation targeting I want to stress is that the inflation target should have a degree of flexibility. That's not to say that the target itself should have flexibility, and that would diminish its usefulness as a medium-term anchor. Rather, some variation in inflation from year to year is acceptable and indeed unavoidable. How much variation is too much? It's difficult to know, but the variation should not be large enough that it generates doubt about the commitment of the central bank to achieving the target. And the fourth and final aspect of inflation targeting I want to emphasise is that the inflation target needs to be accompanied by a high level of accountability and transparency. If the inflation target is operated flexibly and it's nested within the broader objective of welfare maximisation, the central bank has a degree of discretion. We don't have a rule. It's important that when exercising this discretion that we're transparent. Problems can arise if the community doesn't understand our actions or they see us acting unpredictably or inconsistently with our mandate. This means that you should expect us to explain what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how we're balancing the various trade-offs. So these are the four elements that I see as central to an effective inflation targeting regime. And we have all these four elements in Australia. Our commitment to deliver an average rate of inflation over time of 2-point-something provides a strong nominal anchor for the economy. We've always viewed the inflation target in the wider context, reflecting the broad mandate for the Reserve Bank of Australia set out in our Act. That Act was passed 60 years ago this year, and in my view, it stood the test of time. The RBA was also one of the earliest advocates of flexible inflation targeting. That's evident in the use of our words, on average, over time, when describing the target. We also place a very heavy emphasis on explaining our decisions and their rationale to the community. Our overall assessment is that Australia's monetary policy framework has served the country very well over the past three decades. The flexibility that's always been part of our regime has helped underpin a strong and stable economy, and it's also helped Australia deal with some large economic shocks. And as I've said on a number of other occasions, at the Reserve Bank, we're not inflation nutters. Rather, we're seeking to deliver a low and stable rate of inflation in a way that maximises our collective welfare. Over the nearly 30 years that we've had the inflation target, inflation has averaged 2.4%. That's very close to the midpoint of the 2-3% target range. It has, however, been below this average over recent times, and I'll talk about this in a few moments. Before I do so, it's important to note that we periodically review the formulation of the current target, and we also examine alternative monetary policy frameworks, including at our annual conference last year. We're also monitoring closely the discussions that are taking place overseas and in the academic community. In my view, the evidence does not support the idea that a change to our inflation target would deliver better economic outcomes than achieved by our current flexible inflation target. Some alternative frameworks would also be more difficult to implement. I think that'd be more difficult for the community to understand as well. But it is important that we regularly examine the arguments and the options. I would now like to discuss recent inflation outcomes in Australia and the monetary policy response to those outcomes. Like other countries, Australia has had low inflation over recent times. As you can see here, over the past 4 years, headline inflation has mostly been below 2%, although it's been slightly above that mark on a couple of occasions. In underlying terms, inflation has been below the band for 3 years now. Given this history, it is reasonable to ask why this has happened and how the Reserve Bank Board has thought about this. I first want to focus on the period from late 2016, when I became the Governor, to late 2018. Through most of this period, gradual progress was being made in returning inflation to target, and the unemployment rate was moving lower. Inflation was on a gentle upswing, and the unemployment rate was coming down more quickly than we had expected. Reflecting this, in August 2017, the two-year ahead inflation forecast was 2.5%, and since then it's been lower than this, between 2 and 2.25%. Throughout this period, the board discussed the case for seeking a faster and a more assured return of inflation to around the midpoint of the target range. It was natural to be discussing this because having inflation around the midpoint of the target range allows more scope for surprises in either direction. As you know, in the end, the board did not adjust interest rates through this period. It judged that seeking to achieve a faster return of inflation to the midpoint of the target range would have been accompanied by more rapid growth in debt at a time when household balance sheets were already highly leveraged and extended. Our judgment was that, given the progress that was being made towards our goals, it was appropriate to use the flexibility in our inflation target to pursue a course that was more likely to be in the country's long-term interests. We could have generated a bit more inflation, but we would have had faster growth in household debt as well. I acknowledge that others in the community might have seen this trade-off differently to the way that we saw it. But given that the unemployment rate was coming down and inflation had lifted off its trough during that period, we did not see a strong case for easing monetary policy. Towards the end of last year, though, that assessment began to shift. Inflation was turning out lower than we had expected, and our forecasts for inflation were being lowered. There are a few reasons for this, but the one that I want to highlight today is the flexibility of labour supply, as this links back to my earlier discussion on the reasons for low inflation globally. When we prepared our forecasts in mid-2017, we did so on the basis that the share of the adult population participating in the labour market, that's the participation rate, would remain steady over the next couple of years, and you can see that forecast in this chart. At the time, this was considered a reasonable forecast. While we expected some increase in participation due to encouraged worker effect as there was strong growth in employment, we thought that this would be offset by the ageing of the population, so these two things would balance out. As you can see in this chart, since then things have turned out quite differently. Employment growth has been much stronger than we had expected, and the participation rate has risen by 1.5 percentage points, which, as you can see, is a large change over a fairly short period of time. Put simply, the strong demand for labour has been met by more labour supply. It's useful to consider this thought experiment. Suppose the participation rate had still risen materially, but by 0.75% rather than 1.5%. All else constant, that would have meant that the unemployment rate today would have been well below 5%. This flexibility of labour supply is a positive development for the economy and has meant that strong employment growth has not tested the economy's supply capacity. More demand for workers has been met with more labour supply. It's a positive development. But it has contributed to subdued wage outcomes across the country, which in turn has contributed to the low inflation outcomes that we've seen. The more flexible supply side means that employment growth can be stronger without fears of overheating. And at the same time, the unemployment rate that would put upward pressure on inflation is also lower than it once was, and I've talked about this on other occasions. As the evidence has accumulated in support of these propositions, the outlook for monetary policy changed, and the board lowered the cash rate in June and July this year, as you know. In making these decisions, the board also recognised that the earlier concerns about the trajectory of household debt had lessened, and the board has also paid attention to the shift in the outlook for monetary policy globally. These two recent reductions in the cash rate will support demand growth in Australia. So too will the recent tax cuts, higher commodity prices, some stabilisation in the housing market, ongoing investment in infrastructure, and a lift in resource sector investment. And we also need to remember that the underlying foundations of the Australian economy remain strong. It remains to be seen if future growth in demand will be sufficient to put pressure on the economy's supply capacity and lift inflation in a reasonable time frame. It's certainly possible that this is the outcome. But if demand growth is not sufficient, the board is prepared to provide additional support by easing monetary policy further. However, as I've discussed on other occasions, other arms of public policy could also play a role in this scenario. Whether or not further monetary easing is needed, it is reasonable to expect an extended period of low interest rates in Australia. On current projections, it will be some time before inflation is comfortably back within the target range. The board is strongly committed to making sure we get there and continuing to deliver an average rate of inflation in Australia between 2 and 3%. It's highly unlikely that we'll be contemplating higher interest rates until we are confident that inflation will return to around the midpoint of the target range. That, thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thanks, Phil. Your speeches are always timely and topical, but I think particularly so today. So, as Phil said, he's happy to take questions from the floor. As always, please state your name and affiliation when asking a question, and please keep them very short. We've got microphones down the front on either side, and we've got a candidate already. So.
Governor Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. Just wondering if your comment on rates remaining low for an extended period, does that reflect a shift toward forward guidance as you get towards the lower bound of rates?
I wouldn't characterise it like that. I've always tried to be transparent around our thinking. And our thinking is that interest rates are likely to stay low for an extended period because it's hard to see inflation comfortably within the target range for some time. So I wouldn't describe this as a shift in approach to kind of explicit forward guidance. It's just consistent with this view that I've long had that we need to be as transparent as we can about our thinking.
Good afternoon. It's Rory Robertson from Westpac Group Treasury. Governor Lowe, thank you for your important talk and thank you for taking our questions. I actually attended your previous two speeches, one in Brisbane in May and in Adelaide in June. And on each occasion, the thing that struck me about your talk, you know, after 2 or 3 years of not much happening in the monetary policy space, the thing that struck me in those speeches was your explicit inclination to cut rates. And I stood up and asked whether it was fair to say you had a red-hot easing bias. You wouldn't use those words, but you know, subsequently you did cut rates in June and July. So now with rates half a percentage point lower, and as you've just said, you know, the government has cut taxes, and you see some promising straws in the wind in terms of promising signs in the economy. Would it be fair to characterise the Reserve Bank Board its current approach as a patient wait and see approach?
I wouldn't use those words. I would say that we're monitoring kind of the whole range of developments very carefully. What we want to see is more pressure on the economy supply capacity. I think to get that, we need stronger demand growth. We need a lower unemployment rate. And there are a number of developments that can give us some confidence that we're on that track. Lower interest rates, the tax cuts, the pickup in the resource sector and infrastructure investment. But we remain uncertain as to whether that's going to be enough. So we're looking at the various pieces of data as they come in to try and make an assessment about what the likely pressures on capacity are going to be over the coming period. As I said in my prepared remarks, if those pressures are not enough, then we're going to need further stimulus to aggregate demand, and one way of doing that is monetary policy.
Thank you.
Carlos Cacho, UBS. Thank you for your speech, Dr. Lowe. In the July minutes, you noted that a decline in interest rates was unlikely to encourage an unwelcome material pickup in borrowing by households that would add to the medium-term risks in the economy. However, in light of the easing, coordinated easing from the RBA, APRA and the government, are you at all concerned that we could see a repeat of 2016, its rapid price and credit growth? And if so, what would be the appropriate policy response?
Well, I think it's unlikely we're going to see a repeat of what happened in 2016, and I say that for two reasons. First is banks have less appetite to lend at the moment than they did a few years ago. There's been a significant tightening in lending standards, and in some respects it seems to me that some institutions have become excessively risk-averse, so we haven't got the same kind of credit supply impetus that we had a few years ago. And the other thing that's different is the appetite by the household sector to borrow is less than it once was. I think many people in the community feel like they've already borrowed too much, and now is a period to consolidate your balance sheet rather than to go and take out more debt, even at low interest rates. Of course, if either of those two things changed and borrowing started rising quickly again, we'd have to take that into account. But that doesn't seem to me as it's the central scenario at the moment. Both the supply of credit and the demand for credit is less than it was a few years ago.
Placey and Torres Capital. Dr. Lowe, recently we've seen a market inflation expectations trending lower, both market-based and otherwise. How concerned are you that those inflation expectations might be anchoring at lower levels that might be inconsistent with the 2-3% inflation band? And how important is managing inflation expectations in achieving your 2-3% mandate?
Well, we monitor market-based measures of inflation expectations carefully, but I don't put too much weight on them. What I put much more weight on is inflation expectations of people in the real economy, of workers and firms, because they're actually making decisions all the time about prices, firms about their own prices, and workers about what type of wage increases that they can get. So it's inflation and wage expectations by people in the real economy that's really important. And this is one reason why over the past 2 years I've been making the case publicly that a stronger rate of wage growth would be a positive development. In a way, I've been trying to lift wage expectations. I've been concerned that last year, or maybe in 2017, that wage growth had fallen to kind of 2% and was perhaps going to fall lower, and to try and put a floor under wage expectations. If that were to happen, and people thought that wages were going to increase at 2% indefinitely, that would be a major issue. It would make it very hard for my board to achieve its inflation targets. So paying much more attention to what people in the real economy are thinking and saying rather than financial markets.
Thank you.
Dr. Lowe, Elise Morgan from the ABC's The Business Program. Thank you for taking our questions. As you said, the evidence does not support moving the inflation target, you believe, but today the Treasurer was quoted in saying that he would take advice from Treasury on that. Are you confident that Treasury will come to the same conclusion as you? And secondly, you made it clear today that you remain of the view that the federal government could do more to support the economy. Do you believe it should?
I'm not in the business of telling the government what it should do. Part of my role is to lay out options, and I've done that in previous speeches, and I've talked about the option of monetary easing, further fiscal stimulus through infrastructure spending, and in my own view, the best option is to create an environment where firms want to innovate, expand, invest and employ people, and that requires a reform agenda built around productivity. So that's the best option. Whether the government's going to do that, I can't speak for the government. But they're the options, and it's not appropriate for me to tell people what they should do. Am I confident that Treasury will come to the same conclusions? Reasonably, but we've not yet started discussions, but I have had multiple discussions with the Treasury about the benefits of our flexible inflation targeting regime with a kind of an inflation rate centred somewhere in the twos. he and I both agree that it's been a central element in Australia's economic success. So there's a possibility of some drafting changes to the wording on the statement of the conduct of monetary policy, and we'll consider that over coming months. I think there's broad agreement at the political level, certainly in the central bank community, and I hope amongst people in this room, that the framework we've had has served the country well.
Thank you.
Justin Faber from Macquarie. Thanks, Phil. Two quick questions. The first one, if everything's becoming more traded, so less non-traded, where's the productivity growth? Because we're kind of taught at uni the traded sector had much higher productivity and productivity growth than the non-traded sector. I think most countries are struggling with lower productivity growth. So maybe the counterfactual is it's weaker. The second one is on your thought experiment about the part rate not doing much, you know, doing less. That's kind of interesting. I'm reminded, though, that your 2IC, DeBell, said we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't assume the part rate does this. I agree with him. The part rate moves with employment to population ratio. The other work by the bank shows that cyclically it's women and older workers that kind of throw that around. I think that's been the case the last couple of years as well. So why are you then, not that I disagree with you, but why are you then confident that the labour supply side of things has changed that much? Because I don't think that shows it. Maybe other stuff does. Thanks.
On productivity, I'm not sure where the productivity is. Because over the past year, employment growth has been 2.5%. And actually, it's averaged 2.5% for 3 years. So it's strong growth in employment in the economy, and output growth has been less than that. So I think there still remains a puzzle about where the extra output is that all the extra workers are creating. And as we were talking about at my table before lunch, everyone you meet tells you how hard they're working at the moment. So there are a lot of people working, and we're all working harder, but we don't see the output. So please explain, I don't know. The part rate, I can assure you, I discussed my remarks with Dr. DeBell, so there's a close alignment in our thinking.
Did he respond?
Yes, he agreed. And I think what's happening is, as labour demand has been strong, older Australians have stayed in the workforce in a way that they haven't done previously, and more women have either returned to the workforce or stayed in the workforce. And I hesitate to say, but it's almost a structural change. Partly it's being driven by strong demand for labour, but there are other things going on in the society that mean that older people stay in employment longer, which is a good thing, and there are more options for women and people returning from parental leave to work. After all, a third of the workforce now work part-time. A few decades ago, it was like 10%. So working is much more flexible, and that flexibility means more people can work and add to the labour supply. So I think there's something structural going on in addition to just the strong demand for labour. And that extra supply of workers is keeping downward pressure on wage growth. Because when firms want to go and hire people, they might complain that it's hard to find someone, but in the end, they find extra workers without having to increase the rate of wage growth. It's something that's fundamentally different this time. How long it will last, I don't know.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. Thank you for taking the time today to support a great cause. My name is Jane Sadeja, and I'm a student at the Scots College. I've got a two-part question, so I try not to take too much time. This month, the RBA dropped the cash rate to 1%, historic low, obviously trying to adopt an expansionary stance. Now, looking at the RBA snapshots, the most recent ones, we see that economic growth is now at 1.8%, inflation 1.2%, and unemployment is creeping back up at 5.2%. Now, the first question is, what is your forecast for the Australian economy in the near future? And secondly, I recently read that you stated that you urged the Morrison government to increase spending through fiscal policy, and they responded with that the tax cuts would be enough to stimulate aggregate demand. Now, the second question is, if you believe that the tax cuts will be sufficient enough to support aggregate demand and lift it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, just to be clear, I haven't urged the government to do anything. as I said in response to Elise's questions, that's not my job. But I did set out some options, because I do think the country should aspire to a lower rate of unemployment than we currently have. Perhaps a substantially lower rate of unemployment. I think it's achievable, and there are various ways that we can do that. We can't just do it with monetary policy, so I'm laying out some of the options. You asked about our forecast, and I can't answer that precisely because we're currently going through a forecasting round and we'll release those in a couple of weeks' time. But the central outlook still remains reasonable for the Australian economy. As I said before, the tax cuts, the lower interest rates, finally a pickup in the resource sector investment. Resource sector investment's been declining for 6 years in a row. Next year it's going to be positive. So that's been going to be quite a turnaround, and I'm hoping after very large adjustments in the Australian housing market, that process is running its course and that will give people a bit more confidence to spend. So whether that's going to be enough, to come to the third part of your question, I'm unsure. Is there enough growth in aggregate demand to put pressure on the economy's supply capacity? That remains the question. And that's why, from my perspective, interest rate cuts are still on the table, because it may be that there's not enough aggregate demand growth to put pressure on the economy's supply capacity, and we need that pressure to lift inflation up and to get the unemployment rate down. But the questions you're grappling with are easier than the ones that I grappled with 40 years ago, so you can take hopefully some comfort from that.
Good afternoon, Phil. My name is Tapper Strickland from National Australia Bank. And I just wanted to ask your thoughts of, with rates so low on the back of subdued inflation, are you worried about the ability to stimulate the economy? Should the global economy go into a more worrisome downturn? After all, we got German PMI data out overnight, with the German PMI at its lowest levels since July 2012, and the US PMI is at its lowest levels since September 2009. I was just wondering, for the benefits of the students in this room, particularly who are going to be sitting there, the HSC, I was just wondering, were you able to elaborate on what the RBA may or could do in that situation?
Well, I am worried about the global environment. The thing that worries me most at the moment is the disputes about technology and trade are making businesses right around the world very nervous. And when businesses are nervous, they don't want to invest. The option value of waiting goes up, and so businesses sit on their hands. You're seeing in country after country, investment intentions downgraded, investment actually declining. And that's a problem, and it's a problem that's being generated from the uncertainty from the trade and technology disputes. So the best outcome here is to remove that uncertainty. Whether that will happen or not, I don't know. Central banks are responding, or at least the markets are expecting central banks to respond to this, and in almost every major economy at the moment, the markets are forecasting interest rate cuts by the central banks, and they're really responding to this deterioration in the investment climate. At the margin, that will help. But I think there are limits here that what can be done with monetary policy. If the underlying shock is businesses don't want to invest because of uncertainty generated by political events, there's a limited amount that monetary policy can do. It can help, but there's a limited amount. The best thing to do globally, and I think in Australia, as I said before, is to create an environment where firms want to invest, where they want to invest, expand, innovate and employ people. Because it's investment that's the problem globally. And if we can do that with low interest rates and pressure on capacity in a number of economies, I think the global economy can do well. But we need to create this environment where firms want to invest and expand. That would mean higher interest rates, which would be a good thing for all the savers who write to me complaining. It would mean, I think, higher wage growth, because the capital stock would be stronger, and it would mean a higher productivity growth. So the critical issue is to improve the investment climate. Monetary policy can help, but it can't really fundamentally shift that environment.
We're almost out of time, so we'll just restrict the questions to those that are up already. Thank you.
Governor, thank you very much for that speech. That was great. I suppose you speak about there being an extended period of low rates in Australia from here, and you mentioned before that you don't think the housing market's about to take off like it did a couple of years ago, and that seems quite convincing. But what about some of the other potential risks or downsides from this having an extended period of low rates? Where do you see them, and what work is the bank doing to understand them?
So what are the major risks from having an extended period of low interest rates? The main one is more borrowing. And as I said in response to the other question, that we'll probably see a modest pickup in borrowing, but because of reduced credit supply and reduced demand by households, I don't see the kind of this likely to go into another period of very rapid credit growth. If we did, then we'd have to rethink, but at the moment I don't think that's going to occur. So that's the main risk that we worry about with low interest rates. And it doesn't seem particularly elevated at the moment.
No other major risks.
Sorry?
No other major
well,
risks.
Well, I don't want to kind of use this opportunity to kind of list a series of things in the tail, but the primary one is the risk of an extended period of rapid credit growth in an environment where households are already very leveraged. I just don't see that as particularly likely in the next little while for the reasons I talked about. We also have to worry about the capacity to respond if we get hit by an external shock along the lines that I was talking about before. So we still have scope to respond with monetary policy. We have a very flexible exchange rate, which in years past has been the great stabilising force for the Australian economy, and I'll expect that to continue to be the case. And we also have fiscal options. So in the event that we do get hit by an external shock, we still have options.
Hi, thanks Dr. Lowe for your time. It's Adrian Louis from Vinva Services. Are you worried that the focus on expenditures in home loan applications will make applicants game the system by reducing consumption in the lead up to an application? And secondly, what about the privacy concerns of banks combing through transaction records?
Am I worried that households are going to gain their expenses? Not particularly, but what I do hear is that households are paying a lot of attention to making sure that their expenditure record is clean.
Yeah.
So whether you call that gaming, I wouldn't. The people are kind of diligently preparing kind of their expenditure records and what's going through their bank accounts. So
for
that's
example,
probably a good thing.
For example, cancelling Netflix subscriptions, etc.
Well, it's a personal choice. If they want to kind of have a clean record so they can show the bank, they'll fine. But so I'm not particularly worried about that. No, the privacy issue is a real one. The banks have heavy responsibility there to do the right thing. So and I haven't seen any evidence that suggests they're not doing what they need to do properly.
Okay.
Thank you.
David Taylor, ABC. Thank you for your speech. Dr. Lowe, it seemed to me that your job would be made a lot easier if the budget got rid of its, if the government got rid of its ambition to generate a budget surplus. Would you prefer the government drop its ambition of creating a budget surplus?
I think what I would prefer is that the government has a strong agenda that encourages firms to invest, expand, innovate and employ people. As I've said on a number of occasions, that's the primary thing, and that will increase the return on capital, make firms want to invest, it'll allow us to get out of lower interest rates and increase aggregate demand in the economy. So that's what I would prefer. But otherwise, I'm not in the business of giving the government public advice.
Does it hinder your policy making at all? Does it hinder your policy making at all?
I wouldn't say it is hindering our policy making. The passage of the tax cuts, I think, was important. As I've said on other occasions, last year, taxes paid by the household sector rose 10% when gross income was up by 4%. So one reason for weak household spending and weak net income growth is people have been paying a lot of taxes. So I think it was appropriate to give some of those taxes back, so that's helping. And both the state and the federal government have strong infrastructure programs, so they're helping them as well. And in the end, the real help that we can get is an environment that creates a strong investment, a strong climate for businesses to, you heard me, expand, innovate, invest and hire people. That will really help.
If I could just...
We're out of time.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
Hi, Christina Clifton from CBA. So I just wanted to ask you, if you were choosing the level of the inflation target now from scratch, would you choose the current 2-3% target, or would you choose something probably centering on 2% like most other advanced economies? And if you would choose the current 2-3% target, what are your reasons for thinking that inflation should be higher here in Australia than other countries?
The truth is, you can't have I don't have a particularly strong view about what the right number is. What I do have a strong view is, if you've got the number and it's worked for a long period of time, you shouldn't be moving it around. So once you move it once, people might reasonably say, well, they moved it once, maybe they should move it again if the situation changes. So that would diminish the benefit of the inflation target as a strong nominal anchor. So I can't say that 2-3%, so with a midpoint of 2.5, is fundamentally better than 2, or 2 is better than 2.5. The evidence doesn't exist to support that. But I think there's a real benefit in sticking with what we've got, unless it's very clear that something else would be better, and I don't think that evidence exists. So I'm very happy with the flexibility we have in the current formulation, and I don't see a strong case for changing it. Thank you.
Exhausted the questions.
Good.
Please thank Phil again.